Welcome back to the program. Some say that America's best days are behind it, that Americans have become too resistant to change, that the ethos of personal sacrifice that helped grow our nation has become a thing of the past, that we're at an inflection point in which the values and tools of 21st century success will belong to others. In short, the argument is made that the American century is over. The facts, however, can be marshaled to make a very different case. A case that says that the same values and tools that made us great, immigration, creative destruction, quality infrastructure, and world-class education, are exactly the tools we need for the future. That we don't need new tools. We simply have to reinvent and reinvigorate the old ones to work for a new, globalized, hyper-connected century. These are some of the underlying ideas behind an important new book by New York Times columnist Tom Friedman and Johns Hopkins University professor Michael Mandelbaum. It is my pleasure to be joined this morning by Michael Mandelbaum to talk about his new book, That Used to Be Us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented and How We Can Come Back. Michael Mandelbaum is the Christian A. Herder Professor of American Foreign Policy at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. He's a director of the American Foreign Policy Program there. He's also held teaching posts at Harvard and Columbia and the United States Naval Academy. It is my pleasure to welcome Michael Mandelbaum back to this program to talk about That Used to Be Us. Michael Mandelbaum, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be with you and your listeners.
Great to have you here. One of the things that people might find unusual about this book is that two guys that primarily have focused their attention over the years in the realm of foreign policy are writing about what ails America. Talk a little about that.
It's a very good question, and it's really the place that Used to Be Us began. Tom and I have been friends for 20 years. We talk frequently, invariably beginning our conversations on foreign policy topics, but over the last couple of years, we found that those conversations inevitably found their way to the conditions here at home, to the state of the United States, our problems, and our future prospects. And we realized that the future of the United States, the capacity of the United States to meet its challenges, is the most important foreign policy issue for the United States, because if we do not meet our challenges, we will not be able to sustain the global role that we have played for going on seven decades, a role that Tom and I believe is uniquely constructive and crucial for global prosperity and stability. Foreign policy, of course, always begins at home, but things are not well on the home front, and that means that if you're interested in foreign policy, and if, as we do, you want to continue a robust American global role, you have to look at what's wrong at home and what needs to be done to fix things. And that's precisely what we've done.
And in looking at what's wrong at home, one of the things that you talk about is that in many ways the wrong turn that we made really happened as a result of foreign policy. It really happened in response to how we reacted to the end of the Cold War.
Yes, we made a wrong turn or drifted off in the wrong direction beginning at the end of the Cold War in 1991. We misinterpreted, or partly misinterpreted, that great event. We saw it as a great triumph for us, our friends, and our values. And it certainly was that. No doubt about it. We were right in that. But we also took it as an occasion to put our feet up, kick back, relax, and take the position that our greatest challenges were behind us. That was not true. Our greatest challenges in some ways lay ahead, because the end of the Cold War created a new world in which everybody signed up for our kind of economic system, which meant that for individuals and for firms, economic competition was destined to become more intense than ever. And it is more intense than ever, and is getting more intense by the day. That means that we as a nation have to prepare ourselves and have to prepare ourselves as individuals and as firms for a far more competitive international environment, and that, alas, we have lagged in doing.
It was more in some ways, as you talk about it, more than just putting our feet up and kind of taking it easy. We acted in many ways like spoiled children, or as you and Tom call it, the terrible twos.
Well, that's right. We do not have a high opinion of American conduct and American policy in the decades just past. We call the first decade of the 21st century the Terrible Twos because we drifted away from the values that have made us great. In particular, we abandoned what we call in that used to be us sustainable values, that is, values that can see us through to a long-term prosperous future, values that depend upon doing the right thing for future generations. And we got into the habit of acting on what we call in the book situational values, which means do whatever you can get away with at the moment. It's roughly the difference between long-term thinking, the kind of thinking and planning and sacrificing that our parents' generation, the greatest generation, did on the one hand, and the short-term get whatever you can now perspective that, alas, is all too characteristic of the so-called baby boom generation, that is, Americans born between 1946 and 1964, a generation to which both Tom Friedman and I belong. So we are very critical of our own generation and therefore of ourselves.
Is it in fact too late for the baby boomers? I know that both of you are optimistic or cautiously optimistic in terms of how you see the future. But is that because you think that the baby boomers can turn it around, or because you have faith in the new generation, you know, your students at Johns Hopkins, et cetera, who will take this to the next step?
Well, we do have a lot of confidence in the next generation. We see it as an extraordinarily vibrant, creative, inquisitive, resourceful group of Americans. But we also believe that we have to start fixing our problems now. The boomers cannot be satisfied just with passing on these problems to the next generation. We have to take action to meet our challenges now. Now, to be sure, this is in many ways a long-term prospect. But to give you an example, one of the four major challenges that we outline in That Used to Be Us is the problem of deficits and debt. The annual federal deficits and the cumulative total of annual deficits, that is the debt, is really choking us, and they're going to get worse and worse unless we take corrective action. Furthermore, as your listeners will know, there are states and municipalities all over the country that have similar problems, that have made promises to the future that they simply cannot keep. So we have to start scaling back those promises now, and we have to start raising revenue to fill the gap now. So, for example, at the federal level, we need an approach to the deficit which combines three things. First, we're going to have to cut programs, and not just bad programs, not just waste, fraud, and abuse, but important, valuable programs, programs on which people depend. We're going to have to cut our two major so-called entitlement programs, Social Security and Medicare, because we simply can't afford to pay for them as the baby boom generation retires in the form that they now have. We do not advocate scrapping either program, but we think that we're going to have to trim them. At the same time, we're going to have to get more revenue, and that means raising some taxes. Perhaps not marginal rates on income taxes, perhaps through tax reform or through a tax that Tom and I strongly advocate for a variety of reasons that we outline in the book, namely an energy tax. But we're going to have to get more revenue, and just as anybody who says that we need never touch Social Security or Medicare is not being serious, so anybody who says we need never increase the revenue that the federal government gets is not being serious about deficits and the debt. But in addition, in order to prepare ourselves for the world of the 21st century, we're going to have to spend more. There are certain places where we are not spending enough. We're not spending enough on research and development, which is the key to developing technologies that can lead to innovations that will give us the jobs of the future. And we're certainly not spending enough on infrastructure. We're, by one estimate, $2.2 trillion in arrears in refurbishing the roads and bridges and ports and water and power systems that we need. Now, all of that needs to be started now, and that is the task of the baby boomers. We boomers have to act now, and we have to make some modest sacrifices for the sake of the future. Americans have always been willing to do that, and I think that the boomer generation, despite its behavior during the terrible twos, if summoned to do the appropriate thing by competent, coherent leadership, will be willing to follow in the footsteps of all the previous generations that made America great. And that, incidentally, is the reason that this book about America's future has a backward-looking title. That Used to Be Us refers to the programs, the policies, the values, and the spirit that made America great in the past and that we think is still alive and can be revived to secure the future of this country.
All of this, though, certainly requires political will and certainly requires collective action. But in order to do those two things, it seems that there has to be this kind of shared vision. I mean, and this sort of circles back around to the economic issues, because traditionally, as you talk about, it's been the American dream that was kind of the glue that held that vision together.
Well, the American dream is at risk, because if we don't meet our four major challenges, and those challenges besides deficit and debt are the challenges posed by globalization, the challenge posed by the information technology revolution, and the challenge posed by our pattern of energy consumption and its impact on our climate. If we don't meet those, we will not have a growing economy, and that means that the American dream, the capacity of each generation to give the succeeding generation a chance to do even better than it did, will be lost. So there's no doubt that we are at, as you said in the introduction, and inflection point, and part of the purpose of That Used to Be Us is to describe this inflection point and prescribe what we need to do to take advantage of it. But you mentioned the need for political action, and we devote a couple of chapters to that very issue because it is crucial. We believe that the political system is now broken, and it is broken, paralyzed, dysfunctional, chiefly because of the extreme partisanship, the extreme polarization between our two major parties that has taken place over the last 40 years. And in the book, we describe how and why that has happened. There's also the problem of the growing power of money and special interests, and it's also the case that the new media, although a blessing to democracy in many ways, has served to accentuate this polarization. We don't think that one candidate, at least one candidate, one presidential candidate from either of the two parties or one policy or one election can fix this. We think that the country and the political system needs a shock from the outside to get it back into working order. And the shock we suggest in a chapter in the book called Shock Therapy is an independent presidential candidate in 2012, who would run on a platform of meeting the kinds of challenges we now face, that because of polarization, neither the Democrats nor the Republicans are able to confront squarely. We think that if such a candidate emerged, ran on what we regard as a radical centrist platform, and got an appreciable number of votes, if such a candidate did as well in 2012 as, say, Ross Perot did in 1992, that would shock the two political parties. Both would have powerful incentives to move toward the radical center in order to get the votes of those who voted for this independent candidate, and that would help unclog the political system. So we do recognize that collective action is needed, and we do have a suggestion for mustering the political will that has so far been missing to take the appropriate collective action.
How much of that is going to require either in one a candidate from either political party or a third party an ability to really inspire people? You know, one of the things you talk about is how the workplace has changed today, and I think you quote Dub Seidman in talking about, you know, that you can't command collaboration and creativity. It has to be inspired by leadership today. Isn't the same true for our national leadership?
Well, certainly the kind of leadership we need has been unfortunately missing. And we attribute that not to the shortcomings of individual politicians. We don't think that the people who are running the country or running the federal government now are any less able, any less talented, any less intelligent than the people who were in those positions 50 or 100 years ago. We think it's the evolution of the system that has caused this paralysis, and therefore we do need a shock from the outside. But it's true that leadership is important, and in our view, the first and most important thing a leader has to do in order to get the United States on the right track is to ask and answer the most basic kind of question for public policy. And that question is, what world are we living in? In other words, an effective leader has to identify and explain the challenges we face, and then identify and explain the measures we need to meet those challenges. So far, that is not happening.
In talking about those five measures, infrastructure, education, immigration, appropriate regulation, and the research and development you talked about, given how the world has changed, how the degree to which we are hyper-connected, the degree to which globalization has had an impact, and the economic landscape we face today in terms of the debt, why should we assume that these same five areas that have worked for us in the past, that used to be us, as you say, will work to meet the challenges that we face today?
Well, that's a very good question, and as you rightly say, in that used to be us, we identify these five elements of what we call the American formula, a formula for a public-private partnership to underpin the prosperity that we have enjoyed for two decades and more. And as you say, the five elements are education, infrastructure, research and development, appropriate immigration policies, and appropriate regulations. And it's a very good question. If that worked in the past, why would it work in the future? And the reason is that this is a dynamic formula. Each of the elements has constantly changed. Each of them has been adapted to meet the needs of the moment. For example, education has meant more and more education for more and more people to enable the American public and the American workforce to take advantage of the technology that was available. At the beginning of this century, a universal high school education was what the country needed in order to take advantage of the new Industrial Revolution, I should say at the beginning of the last century. Now, we need much more, much better education to take advantage of much more sophisticated and much more broadly diffused technology in order to make Americans what we used to be, and that is the most productive workers in the world. And bear in mind that a nation's standard of living depends upon its productivity. Its productivity depends very heavily on the quality and quantity of its education, and that's why we identify education as being so important for America's future. Indeed, we devote almost a quarter of the book to what we call the education challenge. But to get back to your question, each of these five elements has been dynamic. We have modified our system of education. We have upgraded our infrastructure. We have invested more and more in research and development. We have changed our immigration laws and our regulatory structures to cope with the needs of the moment, and that's what we have to do for the second decade of the 21st century and beyond.
To the extent that part of what has happened within the current economic landscape is this growing gap between the haves and the have-nots, both economically and educationally, and in terms of meeting these challenges of globalization and technology, for example, how do we begin to bridge that gap?
Well, we believe that the necessary condition is economic growth. If we have economic stagnation, we're not going to do anything about income inequality. We're simply going to make it worse, and we're going to make the country worse. We're going to make ourselves a less generous, more contentious people. So the first thing to do is to ensure economic growth, and a good deal of that used to be us is about how to do so in the decades ahead. A second point involves education. It turns out, as many surveys show, that the more education you have, the better your chances of getting a good job. And the gap between the jobs and the incomes of people with a good deal of education and those of, with the income and the incomes and the jobs of people without good education is growing all the time. That means that the key or a key to reducing the growing inequality that we see in the United States is to upgrade our educational system. Indeed, our interviews and our research showed that in the future, in order to have just a decent job, you're going to have both a good high school education and something else. Perhaps college, perhaps advanced vocational training, perhaps the military. But if you have a bad high school education, or if you don't even graduate from high school, in the world of work in the 21st century, you're going to be lost. So education is job one.
There's also the fact that education is not a finite thing. That one of the things you talk about is how jobs and the workplace have to be constantly reinvented. And lifelong education is really the key here.
Yes, it is. And that means that education is going to have to emphasize more and more two things. One, the capacity to learn beyond school. And two, flexibility, adaptation, adaptability, the capacity to invent or reinvent a job, because that will be increasingly important. That is to say, we need to find some way, if there is a way, to instill creativity in as many people as possible. And we have a whole chapter in That Used to Be Us about different efforts to teach creativity. It's not easy. There's no set formula for it. But because of the intense pressure of globalization on every job, creativity, the capacity to do a pretty humdrum standardized job in a different special way, the capacity to invent and or reinvent a job, all these are going to be more important than ever for virtually all Americans.
One of the things you talk about is that we have to look at this, one, as if we are artisans in the way we approach things, and also the fact that we are all sort of strangers in a strange land, that we're all kind of immigrants in this brave new world of what the landscape looks like going forward.
That's right. We use the image of the artisan, the medieval craftsman who put his own or her own name on every individual product, as a way of saying that work is going to have to become more personalized, more individualized, and more tailored for specific circumstances. Standard jobs are really a thing of the past. And as for immigrants, there our point is that everybody has to act as if he or she is in a new world, new circumstances, without any natural advantages except his or her own talents. Nothing is going to be handed to anybody anymore. We're not going to inherit privileges. That is the circumstance of every immigrant, and in the 21st century, that will be the circumstance of almost all Americans.
You talk in a lot of the stuff in education, I mean, you talk about creativity, but also about cooperation and collaboration. I mean, the one theme that emerges in so many of these areas that you and Tom talk about is this idea of collaboration. And in an era right now where we seem so incredibly self-focused and selfish, it's hard to figure out how we get from here to back to there.
I think here our information technology is helpful because it has flattened the world. It has connected more and more of us across a wider geographic scope with more and more frequent interactions. The world has become less vertical and more horizontal. And so I think the next generation, students today, the so-called digital natives, have a natural advantage in this world, and I think they'll do well in it, provided that we boomers give them the tools to do well. It is true that collaboration is more and more important, but as I say, I think that there is a natural bent toward collaboration with the new media that suffuses our lives, and that the rising generation accepts as a matter of course.
It's interesting because you also talk about excellence and the idea that the average is no longer good enough. And there is this delicate balance that we have to find, which does seem to be new, of being able to be overachievers and being able to be above average, but doing it in collaboration and in association with others.
That's right. And not only that, but collaboration is going to be global. The world is so connected, so hyper-connected, as we say in the book, that in order to work on projects, it's possible to get the best talent in the world, no matter where it is. That's why Americans are going to have an ever more global outlook. But I think that, too, is happening, and to the extent that it's not happening, it is the responsibility of our system of education to make it happen. And so I go back to the point that we devoted almost a quarter of that used to be us to education. In fact, we argue that in the 21st century, education is the most important national security challenge that the United States faces.
Talk about it finally in relationship, coming back to the whole foreign policy area, in relationship to the rest of the world, to China and what they're doing, and India and Brazil and the rest of the developing world.
Well, the rise of China and the developing world, the so-called BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, presents American workers and American firms with an enormous challenge, because now the global labor force is about twice as big, and we have to compete, many of us have to compete with people in India and China who are just as smart and who can work for lower wages. It's true that countries don't compete with one another, and when China does well, that's good for everybody, but it does put pressure on individual American workers, which is why we need to prepare our workforce better than we are doing now. But this global world also creates enormous opportunities. It's never been easier to start a business or invent a product or offer a service because of globalization and the information technology. So we say in the book that there's never been a better time to be an entrepreneur or a more challenging time to be a worker. And that is the world in which we are all going to live, so we better get used to it.
And how much time do we have to begin to make these changes?
Well, we've already dug ourselves something of a hole, especially when it comes to deficits and the debt. We really don't have much time to waste. In fact, we don't have any time to waste. We need to start now, which is why Tom and I are so concerned about changing the political dynamics of the country so we can get the collective action necessary for the policies that we need. This is basically an optimistic book because we believe that America continues to have what it takes to thrive, to flourish, and to lead the world. But it's also an alarm book because the hour is late and getting later.
And as you've said, the issue is whether or not we're willing to make the sacrifices to have a difficult decade as opposed to a bad century.
That's right. Sacrifice is on the agenda whether we like it or not. The question is whether it will be self-induced and controlled and directed in such a way as to create a better future, or whether it will be forced upon us by circumstances when we don't expect it and are completely unprepared for it.
Michael Mandelbaum, he along with Tom Friedman are the authors of That Used to Be Us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented, and How We Can Come Back. It is just out from Farris, Straus, and Giroux. Michael, as always, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Great pleasure to be with you.